Heard of this. For those that haven't, it's kind of fun. It's the sort of problem you can tell your friends who are non-physicists and see how they respond. Here's the problem. Imagine there's a factory. You'll notice during this course that my artwork isn't the best, but that's a factory. And this factory makes bombs. So here's a bomb. Each of the bombs has a handle on it. Here's a handle. And then there's also a trigger. Here's the trigger. There. Now, this trigger is so incredibly sensitive that if a single particle of any kind whatsoever impinges on the trigger, the bomb will explode. The only problem is that the manufacturing process here in this factory isn't entirely perfect, and so sometimes what is produced is this. So the bomb has the trigger missing. And the problem is to perform a test to see if the trigger is missing or not. Now, it doesn't matter if in performing this test you explode some of the bombs, but it's essential that at the end of the test you have some bombs that you know have the trigger, and yet you haven't exploded them. Okay? So we say we call these bombs good bombs, inverted commas, obviously. So the problem is to test to find some good bombs, and it doesn't matter if you explode some of the good bombs in the process, but you have to have some good bombs at the end of it which are not exploded. And it would seem that this is impossible because the only way to test to see if the trigger is there or not is to shine some kind of particles onto it, and yet if you do that, the bomb will explode. So it seems like it's impossible to ever have any good bombs without exploding them, all of them. Okay, well, I'll come back to the solution to that at the end of the lecture. Let me just talk a bit about this course. So roughly speaking, there are three parts. In the first part, I'll talk about novel quantum effects. So there's lots of interesting effects in quantum theory, like ways to do this, quantum interference, the quantum Zeno effect, no cloning, all sorts of interesting effects. And by studying them, you can learn something about the nature of quantum theory. They're usually very simple. Part two concerns concepts and interpretation. So concepts are things like, well, you can ask questions like, is the quantum state a real thing or not? You can ask whether quantum theory is non-local. There's Bell's theorem, I think you've covered already. You can ask you can ask what kinds of interpretations you could give of the quantum formalism. There's various interpretations out there, such as the Copenhagen, the many worlds. There's the de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave interpretation, collapse interpretations. So we'll study these things in part two. And then in part three of the course, I'll talk about reconstruction, reformulation, and and going beyond quantum theory. By reconstruction, I mean, can you find, well, if you look at the standard formalism of quantum theory, the set of axioms that give you quantum theory, they're kind of abstract and not very satisfactory as axioms. You can contrast them, for example, with the axioms of special relativity. So the axioms of special relativity are somehow very intuitive, that physics is the same in all reference frames and that the speed of light is constant. Whereas the axioms of quantum theory, as they're normally presented, concern complex vectors and Hilbert space and so on. They're kind of abstract, and it would be nice to find some set of principles that you could reconstruct quantum theory from. A reformulation of quantum theory. There's many different ways of formulating quantum theory, and each of them are useful for different reasons. So we'll look at some of the possible formulations of quantum theory and think about what we can gain by formulating it in different ways. And then the question of beyond. It seems to me that the best reason to study quantum foundations is that you can use it to help you make progress in physics. You know, there are big open problems in physics, in particular the problem of quantum gravity, finding a theory of quantum gravity. And then by looking at the conceptual issues in quantum theory, we may have some clues on how to solve those problems. So from my way of thinking, this is the most important reason to look at the subject. I want to make it clear that during this course, interruptions are completely welcome, so you can interrupt me at any point, ask questions. I'm going to try to make the course simple. You should be able to follow everything I say, but yeah, and you're welcome to ask questions if something is unclear. Certainly, in previous years, that's been a very good way to clarify the points I didn't make clear. Okay. So I'm going to start part one looking at novel. Actually, I'm going to start by trying to understand yet again how to use this machine. Okay. Yes, I'm successful. Okay, so I'm going to start by looking at some novel quantum effects. And I've always found that quantum interference is a very good way to get a sense of what kind of theory quantum theory is. So I'll start by looking at interferometers. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the building blocks that you can use to make up an interferometer. And then we'll discuss a few examples on how to put those building blocks together to actually build interesting interferometers. So these are sort of like the Lego blocks. And in the first place, I'll consider just one particle interferometers. So, the first thing we have is a source. So a source, some box that has a button on it that you press, and it produces a particle traveling along a path. I'm going to represent the state that's produced by putting a ket around the symbol s associated with this path. I'll use different symbols for, I'll use different lowercase letters for different paths. The next thing we have is a path length. So a certain length of path inside an interferometer, if I call this path A, then what happens is that the path, the state coming in evolves to e to the I L over lambda times the original state. So you pick up a phase corresponding to the path length. Next thing is a phase shifter. So here, a phase shifter is just a piece of glass, which I always represent by a triangle, although thinking about it now, that doesn't really make sense. It would be better to represent it by a rectangle. Oh, I see. But still, if the beam has any thickness, then you'll get a variable phase shift along the. Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense, though. Yeah. So you can imagine if it's a very, very, a triangle with a very, very, what is the word? a very long triangle, then it would make sense because then it wouldn't. Yeah. Okay. Good. So it's just a piece of glass. And that also induces a phase shift. Like so. The next thing is a mirror. So again, all that a mirror can do is put a phase shift on your on the in front of the state, and I'm going to take the phase shift to be I. It doesn't really matter what number you put there, but I is useful because it's consistent with the expression I'll use for a beam splitter next. Even if the phase shift wasn't I, you could always just vary the path lengths in the vicinity of the mirror very slightly and make it so that the phase shift was I, the phase factor was I. So it doesn't really matter. Of course, a mirror can be in different configurations. It could also be like this. Next. Okay. Isn't quite what I expected. Next thing is a beam splitter. A beam splitter, well, if this was optics, if this were photons, then a beam splitter would be a piece of glass with some silvering on it, but only half silver, or only partially silvered, so it wouldn't be a mirror. It would allow there'd be some probability of the photon going through and some probability of the photon being reflected. For other types of particle, like I think for electrons, for example, you could use a charged wire to split the beam. So if you have a beam of electrons coming towards a charged wire, then it will split the beam into two pieces. So you can imagine different physical ways of implementing beam splitters for different types of particle. But in any case, the treatment is going to be the same. So you have two paths coming in and two paths coming out. And one way to implement this is the following. Oh, the other thing that associated with a beam splitter, there is a certain transmissivity and reflectivity. You can think of this as being the probability of being transmitted or reflected. And we're going to assume that these beam splitters are non-absorbing so that these two numbers add up to one. It wouldn't be difficult to treat the case where they were absorbing. We'll stick with the simple case. So that's the transformation we'll have at a beam splitter. So you'll notice that on reflection, we pick up a phase factor of I. On transmission, we don't. So this is just one choice. There's many possible choices of transformation as a beam splitter, but they're all essentially equivalent to this modulo small phase differences. But it's important that the transformation you choose here is unitary. And in the literature, every now and then, people will make a mistake and choose a non-unitary transformation. And when you do that, you can do all sorts of crazy things like signal faster than the speed of light. So people get very excited and ask for a Nobel Prize. So it's essential to choose a unitary transformation. Just to show you that this is unitary. First of all, for every one of these states, we have. Sorry. That the state is normalized, etc. So for every one, so for A and for B and for C and for D, we have that the states are normalized. And then also we have that the inner product of A and B is zero, and also of C and D, because those are distinguishable situations. So now we need to show that this transformation is unitary. Does anyone know how to prove that? Just out of curiosity. Yeah. Say it again. They have
the states to which they transform are orthonormal.
Yeah, right. That's all you have to say. Yeah. So these two states are orthonormal, and so afterwards you just check the inner product of this, and sure enough, because you have the I's, you get cancellation, so you get zero. Okay. I won't write the calculation out, but it gives you zero on this side. Okay, a few more building blocks, and then we can look at some interferometers. So you have detectors. So detector, just represent it by this. And I put the same letter in here, but uppercase, associated with the detector. And a detector does this. So what happens is the particle comes in. The detector is initially in the zero state, so the kind of ready state. And then the particle is absorbed and the detector fires. We represent that like this. Also, you can imagine detectors that do this, so detectors that don't actually absorb the particle. They simply detect the particle. So the particle comes in. The detector is in the ready state, zero state. And then afterwards, the particle is detected. And in this case, the particle carries on. So this detector clicks, but the particle passes through. Okay. Okay, are there any questions on this at this stage? All very simple. Good.
Do we assume that the particle stay the same after it has the particle?
Right. Good question. So, so it's possible, of course, that the particle state changes after the detector, So first of all, actually, it's very difficult to build anything like this that detects a particle without absorbing it. And suddenly, if you tried to do it, then most likely it would disturb the particle. But this is kind of a sort of Gedanken experiment. We're just setting up some very simple, this is a theorist's approach to quantum interferometry. So in principle, it's possible that the particle isn't disturbed. And the way to see that is to show that you can embed this into a unitary transformation. So you can find a unitary transformation for which this is one of the allowed transformations. Okay. On that note, one other thing I should mention is that I'm assuming monochromatic interferometry. So we just have a given fixed wavelength for all our particles. Strictly speaking, you should any real experiment would have you'd have some spread over wavelengths. Doesn't really affect the conclusions we draw. You can get arbitrarily close to the effects we'll see with even if you have a spread over wavelengths. Any more questions? Okay. So I'll go on to some examples. Before the first example, there's the zero example. You have a source for some kind of particle. I guess I'll represent that by A. And then you have a detector for that kind of particle. So you press the button, the particle comes out, the detector clicks. It's all very straightforward. So what happens there is that the state evolves like that. Okay. So now the first example, which is also very simple. Is where you have an interferometer. And then after the interferometer, you have phase shifters and detectors. Okay. So although this is very simple, it's kind of important because it's only by appreciating what happens in this experiment that what happens in the interference experiment becomes somehow important. And more than that, you may have heard of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument from 1935. But even earlier than that, Einstein had some arguments in 1927 of a similar flavor showing that quantum theory is, in some sense, non-local. There's a kind of spooky action at a distance, as he put it. And you can make that argument even in the context of this very simple experiment. So it's not trivial from a conceptual point of view. So, but let's do the mathematics. So we start off with a particle coming in. And then we have two detectors in the ready states. Now the particle evolves through the beam splitter, so the sum term corresponding to it being reflected, and then it goes through the phase shifter. And then there's another term corresponding to it being transmitted. And then it goes through the phase shifter on that arm. So that's the state that we have. And now we can simply see what happens when this particle impinges onto the detectors. So if the particle, so this term in the superposition will cause the B detector to fire, and the other term will cause the C detector to fire. And now we can write down the probabilities for various different patterns of detectors firing. So the probability that you get B firing and C doesn't fire is the square magnitude of the term in front of that, so the expression in front of that term. And it is indeed R, which is what we expected. The probability we get detector C firing and detector B doesn't fire is given in the same way. We get T. And then also we have that the probability that neither detector fires is zero, and so is the probability that both detectors fire. So the two kind of features that we have here are we see anti-correlation. And we also see that there's no dependence on the phases. Okay, all kind of straightforward. Because if you actually do this experiment, then you have to contend with experimental imperfections. And then you'll find that these numbers aren't exactly equal to zero, but something close to zero. And an experiment like that was done with photons in the group of Alain Aspect and Grandier in Paris. Of course, they get some number which isn't quite zero. Then you have to ask, well, are you really seeing the quantum effect or not? So more or less trivial, but not completely trivial. Okay, it's the second example. is the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. I can't spell Zehnder. There's an H there, isn't there? So this is like this. So you have some source, you press a button, particle comes in, hits a half silvered mirror with some reflectivity and transmittivity. Then there's a phase shifter in each path. I'll call the internal paths U and V. Then we have another beam splitter, which has its own reflection and transmission coefficients. We have some paths coming out, D and C. And we have detectors in those paths, like so. OK. So if I was to do the example in this full generality here, it's a little bit messy because you've got different R's and T's in the two cases. And we've got phase shifters in both sides. It's not difficult, but what I'll do is I'll just do the, I'll do a simplified case. Like this. Where the beam splitters are 50-50. Okay, and there's no phase shifters. So in this case we have and I'll just to keep it simple, I won't put the detector states in. So this the particle comes in, passes through the first beam splitter, so the state goes to that. And then it passes through the second beam splitter. So now what we have to do is separately evolve each of these vectors through the second beam splitter. At that. Any questions? So far? Straightforward. Okay. So now if you go through and look at this, well, there's an I times I here, which puts a minus sign in front of this D. But this one has a plus sign in front of it. So the D's cancel. The C's do not cancel. And what you get is that this is equal to I times C. So what that means is if you were to put the detectors in, then detector C would click. And not D. So So the notation I've taken here with U and V and C and D, I took it from the Elitzer-Weidman paper. And so I don't know why they chose this notation, but I've always assumed that D was chosen because it stands for dark. Because in the most standard configuration, detect D doesn't click. There's a sort of interesting phenomenon here, even a very simple experiment, but there's something interesting that happens. If you look at the two different possibilities of having a detection here, a detector C, one possibility is that you take the path U. So you have, you pick up a 50% chance of that happening here, and another 50% chance of that happening here. So the probability, it would seem, that you go from here to here by that route is a quarter. And then likewise, the probability you go by this route would also seem to be a quarter. So you seem to get something like a quarter plus a quarter equals one. Obviously, that's the wrong way to do the calculation. You have to use quantum theory. And in quantum theory, you take the square root, then you add, then you take the square. And that's how you get one. And you know, also, more generally, you could think about if you have two processes, both having probability p, then in quantum theory, you don't get 2p. If you have constructive interference, then you can get 4p. This is when you have constructive interference. So the chance of something happening is twice as likely as it would as you would think according to the most naive argument. Okay. Let me go over here. So here's another example. This is where you put a phase shifter of pi in one of the two paths. So e to the I theta, theta is equal to, or phi rather is equal to pi. So the phase shift, it gives you a minus sign. And everything else is going to be the same. So in this case, well, we do the same mathematics, except that we have to put a minus one sign in here. And what we get then is that the particle is always detected at detector D. Okay. So detector D, yeah. It always comes out here, so detector T clicks. And the same is true. Same is true if you put a plate inside this path instead. So if you think about these facts, the fact that if you have no plates in there, and the fact that if you have a plate in either of the two puffs with phi equal to pi, then you can give an argument that something goes along both puffs. And the argument is this. So you could imagine trying to account for what happens in this experiment by, in terms of an explanation where a particle went only one way or the other. So let's try to do that. So imagine the particle comes in here and it goes this way. Then it arrives at the second beam splitter. Now, it has to make a choice whether to go this way or this way. If there's no phase shifter here, then for sure it has to go this way. But if there is a phase shifter here, then for sure it has to go that way. On the other hand, the particle went along this path, so it didn't see the phase shifter. So an explanation in terms of something only going along one path without having any sense of what happened in the other path simply fails. So a naive particle explanation fails. I mean, obviously, you've seen the same argument in terms of the double slit interferometer. In some sense, this is a cleaner version because you only have two paths inside. Here's another situation you can consider. I guess this could be the third example. So what we're going to do now is place a detector in each of the internal paths. And it's going to be the kind of detector that allows the particle to pass through afterwards without being absorbed. So like this.
When you said explanation phase, does it mean that you don't detect anything or you detect a form?
What I'm saying is if you try to explain what happens in this experiment, well, with these three experiments, with the phase shifter here or here or no phase shifter, in terms of a simple particle passing along one of the two paths, then you can't account for what you actually see in the experiment. This is not an explanation for the experimental data in the experiment. Is that clear? Okay. Any more questions? Because although it's very simple stuff, it's worth thinking about. But we haven't. We haven't quite got to that yet. We'll come to that after this example. It's not quite the same, but it's certainly related. Certainly using the interferometer is how to solve the Elitzer-Weidman problem. Okay. Let's have a drink. Okay, so now we have this experiment. So we press the button, particle comes out, hits the first beam splitter. And then if it goes this way, there's a detector here. that can detect it. If it goes this way, there's a detector here that can detect it. But whichever detector the particle passes through, it still continues onto the second beam splitter where it can be detected here or here. Okay. So the question is, what happens in this case? So in this case, you no longer have interference because you have information about which of the two paths the particle went through. Well, it's interesting to actually do the calculation and see why you lose interference. Let's see. I'm tempted to just quickly point out the reason. Let's see. If I was to take the expression that I have at the top over there, no, not there. Where is the interferometer? Here, this one. If I take this expression, but I'm just going to add these two detectors inside in their internal states. Okay. And so we still have them here. Oh, no, no, sorry, I'm sorry. Okay, so now maybe I should just continue. This is going to get messy. I'll do it over here. I'll do it properly. So the next step is that we have this term causes the U detector to fire, not the V detector. And then we have over here that the V detector fires, but not the U detector. Now we can substitute again as we did last time for U and V as they evolve through the second beam splitter. So here we have a C and a D term. Over here we have a C and a D term. And now, remember last time, because we had I times I here, the D term canceled. But that doesn't happen this time, because here we have this extra term, which is different. So now the D terms don't cancel. And so we don't have interference. And if you go through the calculation, you'll see that the particle is just detected here randomly, 50-50. Same thing. So yeah. So if you ignore the if you ignore what happens at the detectors, then you get 50-50. If you look at you've only considered the cases where you get this particle, this detector fires, and this one doesn't, you get 50-50. Same with this one. But there is an interesting case, and I think it's in one of the homework of the tutorial. The second tutorial. There is an interesting thing you can do is you afterwards after the particle has been detected over here. You can say, well, actually, I'm going to interfere these two detectors. So rather than choosing to look to see if this one or this one fired, I'm going to measure them in a base which is orthogonal to this detection basis. You can do that if you store the detection result at the microscopic level. And then, so you'll get one of two answers to that measurement. And depending on that answer, you'll see interference in the two outputs. It's called the quantum eraser. It's so you can kind of recover the interference post-selected on what result you get here. Yeah, that's the quantum eraser. Okay. So let me finally come back to the bomb. Oh, just let's see. I'm going to press, see what happens. Okay, so the solution to the bomb problem, you build an interferometer like this. No phase shifters, so just the simplest kind of interferometer. And now you take the bomb, very carefully, obviously, by the handle. And you place it so that the trigger, if it's present, protrudes into one of the two paths through the interferometer. Okay. Now, various things can happen. So one thing that can happen, and you can back all this up by calculation. I think this is also in one of the tutorials here. One thing that can happen is that, the particle comes along here, hits the trigger, the bomb explodes. Okay, so in that case, you've wasted that bomb. And you didn't succeed in testing it and keeping it. Okay, so the second thing that can happen is that this detector fires, C. Well, if the trigger is absent, if there's no trigger here, then that's what you would expect to happen, because this interferometry is set up so that the particle come out here and not in this detector. On the other hand, it's also possible for this detector to fire if there is a trigger present, because what could happen then is the particle could come along here. If you do the calculation, you'll see there's no amplitude corresponding to anything coming along here after this point. And so it's possible this particle will go 50% either this way or this way. So it's possible for this to fire. So you can draw no conclusion here. The third thing that can happen is that detector D fires. Well, in this case, you can conclude that it was a good bomb, that the trigger was present. And the reason for that is that if it was a bad bomb, if the trigger was missing, then this would just be an interferometer with no obstructions. And so the particle would have to be detected here. Therefore, if you see a detection here, you know that one of the internal paths must have been blocked, and consequently, that means that the trigger was present. However, you haven't actually exploded the bomb. Any questions? Is it clear what's going on? It was when I saw this paper, I was kind of fortunate. This was back in like 1990 or thereabouts. Back in those days, it was before people used, well, I think it's actually before the archive, before the preprint server. And so in those days, people sent physical copies of the paper around. And so I was fortunate that my supervisor was sent a copy of this paper. And we, you know, we spent a lot of time discussing it. And it's such a simple example, and yet no one came up with this before 1990. It's somehow very surprising from one point of view, and yet kind of obvious from another point of view. It motivated some of my own research subsequently, and I think you'll learn about one of the examples in the tutorial. Yeah. So that's the solution to that problem. Just in the few minutes that remain, I'll just mention two-particle interferometry. So if you want to do two-particle interferometry, then you need a source for two particles. You could just have two separate sources like this. And you can do interesting things with such sources. Actually, the example that I mentioned that you'll look at in the tutorial is like this. Or you can have special sources that are good for that produce pairs of particles. So, so here's the idea: you have particle one over here, particle two over here, and particle one comes out over here, and particle two comes out over here, or particle one comes out over here, and particle two comes out over here. And so the idea here is that you have a source that emits pairs of particles, but their directions are correlated. If particle one goes out this direction, particle two goes out in the opposite direction over here. And if particle one goes out in this direction, particle two goes out in this direction. And the state that you prepare is like that. There's actually a very good way of preparing this state in quantum optics using something known as parametric downconversion. In that case, what you do is you have a certain specially manufactured crystal has certain properties. And you send a laser through it, then you absorb the laser afterwards. And then there's some small probability that a photon in this laser beam will be down converted into a pair of photons whose energies add to that of the original photon. And their momenta will be well correlated. So if this photon comes out this direction, this one might come out in this direction. And if this one comes out, this would be A. If this one comes out in this direction, this one will come out in this direction. And then you can pick out using pinholes the different possibilities. So Aggie can tell you a lot more about that than I can. It's a very interesting phenomenon. This has been used to produce entangled states in a lot of the experiments that have been done in quantum optics to test Bell's theorem and such like. What you can do now is you can take these two paths. For each particle, and combine them as a beam splitter, and look and see what happens. And what you'll see is that you get a kind of interference. The interference depends not just on either phi 1 or phi 2, but on, depends on the on some linear combination of those two. In this case, with that state, it'll be the sum. And so it's interesting if you have some spare time on your hands to sit down and do this calculation and see how the interference looks. It's quite fun. It's sort of the two particle analog of one particle interference that you've discovered, you've looked at already. Okay, I'll stop just there.